Tel Aviv has become one of the world's top gay destinations. It's a distinction that's taken in moments of personal sacrifice, shootings, and thousands of pounds of investment from the mayor. But has the city's gay and lesbian cause been co-opted and used as a public relations tool by Israel? I'm Tim Samuels for the BBC World Service, and in this programme I'll be asking what it's like to be gay in Tel Aviv. Around me, Tel Aviv Pride Parade is beginning. You'd expect this parade to be something entirely secular, a hedonistic celebration that, particularly in Israel, simply doesn't mesh with the more holy parts of the land. But in Tel Aviv, most, if not all, of your expectations are confounded.
Where are we running to?
To the car. Well, I'm supposed to be there in 1 o'clock and I'm already late. And to dance the Jewish dancing.
Okay.
So run with me.
I'll run with you.
Zahrut Sorek is an Orthodox Jew from Jerusalem, but she'll be spending today dressed in red, dancing in front of the lead car of the biggest gay pride parade in the Middle East.
She's about 4'8", but she's a fast runner, and I'm struggling to keep up, and I'm wearing black. I think the Yiddish word is schwitzing. I'm sweating heavily.
Zahrut married a man when she was 20, but age 31, she divorced her husband and entered into a lesbian relationship.
Why are you so passionate about this?
That's my wife!
Hi.
She celebrates 40 years today!
Happy birthday!
So, it's very important for us that people will hear our voice. We have a unique voice. We are gay and lesbian and queer. And we are religious. The people say, you shouldn't be here, you shouldn't exist.
Who says this to you?
People are homophobia all the time. And I try to explain them, and I'm here. Look, I'm here, I'm a lesbian, Orthodox and gay.
Gay pride in Tel Aviv. The kitsch, the camp, the secular, the Orthodox. I came here during the week-long celebrations to understand how this city has become an international gay mecca.
Like 5 years ago, there was no money. No one believed gay tourists would come and celebrate. And this year we spent like 1 million shekels on promoting Tel Aviv as a gay capital. And last year we won the best gay city in the world.
Looking down on thousands of revelers dancing on the beach, this hasn't all happened by chance. In 2007, Israel's Ministry of Tourism launched a concerted effort to woo the gay community. Money was spent to attract the pink dollar. Poster campaigns even featured tattooed yarmulke-wearing men. And within 4 years, Tel Aviv, a traditionally machismo country in the heart of the Middle East, was voted best gay city in the world. A driving force behind this strategy is Councilman Yaniv Weizman.
When I started dealing with the gay tourism, we did a research and we asked if they know the difference between the brand Tel Aviv and the brand Israel. Israel, they thought about war, conflict. And when you talked about Tel Aviv, they thought about freedom. And this time, it was the first time I was brave enough to talk about pride in the Middle East.
Is it true that you flew hot Israeli gay guys around the world to kind
yes.
of be ambassadors?
Not just gays, but even lesbians and transgender. We had for the last 4 years groups from Tel Aviv who flew all over the parade and just perform and ask people to come to Tel Aviv and celebrate with us. These people became ambassadors of Tel Aviv, you know, and I knew that if tourists will come, it will make our community stronger. You know, every tourist who come to Tel Aviv spent around $2,000. You know, it's great for the city, great for the nightlife, great for the community. I love my country, I love Israel. And I think it's doing so good to Israel, the image of Israel all over the world.
Away from the street draped in rainbow flags lies the functional-looking campus of Tel Aviv University and an unassuming chemistry professor tucked away in his lab who's seen as instrumental in the history of gay rights in Israel.
The thing is probably the fastest mechanical device on Earth. It can open and close in something like 20 millionths of a second.
Long before Professor Uzi Evan created his superfast valve, he was a talented nuclear scientist in the army, until his sexuality got in the way. In the early 1980s, these were tough times to be gay.
Society regarded us as something that is abominable. The subject was never discussed. There were many jobs that we were prohibited from taking. And in the law book, we were subject to 8 years of imprisonment.
And were you harassed by the police?
Yes. It was the standard operating procedure. And that was the law of the country at that time, the law we inherited from you.
From the British Mandate?
From the British Mandate, yes.
And were people put in jail?
Overnight, yes. But the atmosphere was that you couldn't come out. If you came out, you pay such a heavy price.
At this point, how did you live a gay life? How did you meet people? How did you socialize?
Underground. Like you see in the movies in Hollywood, you know. We were always considered either danger or mentally disturbed. It's a horrible period.
At the time you were dismissed from the army, what were you doing in the army?
Well, I served for almost seven years in the military. I used to handle very sensitive material. And when they found out that I am gay, I was summarily discharged without any way to debate it or argue with it or explain it even.
And when they discharged you from the army, were they apologetic?
No. At that time the atmosphere was different, you see. It was in 82. And I had to wait almost 10 years before I could get my chance to change that law.
So you took this decision, you're going to go public, you're going to push yourself into the public eye as someone who's ahead of a chemistry department and has been working on national security, people that Israelis could relate to, and you addressed the Knesset, the parliament.
I addressed the Knesset, and I probably did a good job because the reaction in the media was beyond my expectation. And it had a good story to tell, how because we are gay, we are marginalized in country life. And all I asked was to treat us as equal.
Can you remember any lines from the speech?
Yeah. Please let us serve our country.
Back then, the Israeli army didn't ask conscripts about their sexual orientation. Openly gay soldiers weren't drummed out of the service, but they did have to undergo psychological evaluation if they were found to be gay or openly declared it. Uzi's speech helped change all that, and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, a former Army Chief of Staff and Defence Minister, ordered that the Army's practices be re-examined.
Got called to the Prime Minister office, Rabin, and told him I want that what happened to me will not happen again. And the committee was established. In 3 months, the law was changed. It was signed by the Chief of Staff at that time, Ehud Barak. And it started an avalanche of processes that other government agencies followed, and started an avalanche that created the gay-friendly atmosphere that you find now in this little country in the middle of the Middle East. The new law that was put then into effect starts with the words that the Israeli Defense Force do not discriminate against gay or lesbian people.
How did you feel when you left the building, having spoken to Rabin, having seen the army heads, knowing that the law was going to change?
I felt that my place is assured in heaven. What can I say? The time was right.
The military's changed its laws, but do you think that how you say it is now in the military?
I see how many young people are openly gay in the military, including myself. And he didn't suffer from it. No? If you are honest about yourself, no, you don't have to be afraid anymore. We don't have special units for gays. We don't put them in special showers. We don't do anything.
Well, what would a special unit do?
Leave me out of
there. Yeah. But then you took this further and you decided to stand for Parliament. Were you the
As an openly gay representative.
The first openly gay.
The first openly gay. Which again created a media frenzy. And
how important was Yael Dayan in bringing
absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. She's considered the mother of our gay community. Because without her initiative, I'm not sure that all these changes would take place. without her, I don't think we would be where we are today.
Yeah, your city, Tel Aviv, you know, it's about to become this kind of gay party town. Thousands of gay people are flying in from around the world. Will you be marching?
Yeah, I will. I have been doing it for so many years, as long as I can walk.
Is it for you still an emotional occasion?
Of course. Tel Aviv now is a country where you can walk hand in hand, live your life. Almost no hate crime except for one deplorable incident that is still open, the shooting in the gay, in the youth. How can you define freedom if you never were incarcerated? I was living through both periods. It's true. A large change that I've seen in my life. And I like to think that I have something to do with it.
Tel Aviv is a different city, and Israel a very different country to when Uzi first came out as gay. Apart from an isolated tragic incident in 2009, when a masked gunman opened fire with a pistol at a gay youth club, killing 2 and wounding 15, gay life is an effortless part of the mainstream. According to Uzi Evan, much of the credit for this should go to Yael Dayan, who lives here in Rabin Square. She's the daughter of Moshe Dayan, the eyepatch-wearing former prime minister and one of the most charismatic military leaders of modern Israel. After returning from spending time in New York with bohemian characters like Andy Warhol, she questioned what she found in her own country and took up gay rights when she entered the Israeli parliament.
Hi, I'm Tim. Real pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
What a lovely view you've got over Rabin Square.
Yeah. I was voted in 1992, and that's where my story began. And I had an agenda which included human rights, women's rights primarily, and gay rights. I had my way of doing it and imposing the subject actually on the Knesset. The big objection came from the religious and Orthodox sector, which I think is worldwide too.
When you first introduced Professor Evan to the Knesset, were you worried about how he was going to be received?
Not at all, because I worked with the community and we had lots of friends. The noise against was very superficial. It was very dramatic. The Orthodox was saying that if I have this conference in the Knesset, they will tie their hands with chains to the gates of the Knesset, and the words themselves, homosexual, lesbians, were never heard in the Knesset. I mean, the Orthodox to this day talk about sickness, disease. They were not being able to pronounce the word, so they would say something like homo lesbians and spitting after saying these awful words.
How would someone like your father, Moshe Dayan, have viewed gays in the army? Did you ever talk to him about gay rights?
I did, but it was not against it. I had gay friends who would, you know, come home, and he just couldn't quite figure it out. He said, from birth, do they have to do it? Can they do both? And so he wasn't even very curious about it. He was very accepting socially. It just didn't seem to him something that is so great. We talk about Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv sets the tone for a lot of norms and cultural attitudes and ideologies. Of course, Tel Aviv is not like Jerusalem, but Tel Aviv sets a tone for the rest of the country.
If Jerusalem is the city of one's inner life, Tel Aviv is of the outer. Tel Avivians wear their lives on their sleeves. Life is lived almost entirely on the open. The city has the bustling commercialism of Wall Street, the sprawling informality of Miami Beach, a Paris-like charm, and a series of doingness. Cafe sitting in those days was Tel Aviv's answer to television.
And when did you write this?
Well, must have been in 1970. I'm Diana Lerner, and I've been a freelance since I came here, and my articles have appeared in every single Hebrew newspaper because I sold them like apples. I met everybody here, poets, Ella Fitzgerald.
What would life have been like if you were gay in Jerusalem in the 60s?
I think it would have been very difficult. They came to Tel Aviv because it was easier in Tel Aviv, and they weren't so critical in Tel Aviv, and it wasn't so religious in Tel Aviv. I had very close gay men friends, and they would say, you see this one and that one? He was my lover, and he was my this, and he was my that.
Tel Aviv has always defiantly shrugged off the realpolitik of its location, an hour from Jerusalem and the West Bank, within striking distance of Lebanon and Syria. Yet Tel Aviv has long been a magnet for writers, painters and musicians, home to symphony orchestras, chamber ensembles, countless art galleries, museums, bookstores and a vibrant nightlife. Walking down the tree-lined streets in the centre of Tel Aviv, past gay couples pushing prams, there's a gay acceptance right up there with San Francisco or Sydney. For Gal Yukovsky, a screenwriter, and until recently, one of the hosts of Israeli Pop Idol, this gay tolerance is rooted in the morbid peculiarities of Israel's precarious position.
Ever since this country was founded, people die here young. If you're an Israeli mother or an Israeli father, the one thing you think of when you have a child is, how do I bring this kid to be a grown-up without dying? So when this is the way you think, everything that is not dying is not that bad. He's alive, he's gay.
Well, so it's like gay, a nation of sort of worried Jewish mothers saying, my son, he's alive, he's gay, but at least he's alive.
Yes, but when you say it, it sounds like a joke. But in Israel, since people really die, but it really happened, but it's really there. One of the interesting thing about Israel is that the acceptance of gay people in Israel is deeper and fuller than in any country in the Western world.
Really?
Yeah.
In what sense?
Israel has been locked in this Middle East conflict for years. And it doesn't even matter if you're right or left, if you really believe that Palestinians should have their own country or you're a right-wing settler. Most of the time, when you don't think about it, you're really angry or devastated that it's there. And you really want it to go away, but it doesn't go away. So you're this occupier, you feel ashamed, you know, in conversations. But the gay route is a way for most mainstream Israelis to feel that they are enlightened, to feel that they are progressive, to feel that they are open-minded. We accept the gays. We hate the Arabs, but we accept the gays.
Is this Israel making itself feel better because it can talk about something positive and the gay scene and not talk about the conflict? Or is it about Israel projecting to the outside world that, hey, we're not all about conflict and oppression, we're gay and we're tolerant and we're liberal?
What you're talking about now is what we call pinkwashing. It's the thing that the government, the right-wing government, understood like 2-3 years ago, that you can work with the gays. But it's the funny side of it, to my point. The real thing is that the whole acceptance of gays has nothing to do with the world. It's about accepting ourselves. It's about when they look at the mirror, they feel much better that they know that here is this one issue that they're good about, and it's not the conflict.
That Tel Aviv is a bastion of gay freedom in a region that's anything but is a source of personal pride for the city's mayor and a good return for the marketing money he invested. On the morning of the Pride March in Meir Park, beside the impressively municipally funded gay centre, and amidst a gaggle of security, supporters and suited politicians, I grab a word with the mayor, Ron Haldai.
From BBC, from London.
From London? Yeah. Please, come to the shade.
Oh, London.
We get the shade.
Then you put a lot of deliberate effort into this. You spent money to promote this in Israel and around the world. This has been a policy of yours.
Yeah, of course.
How much have you spent, do you think, promoting gay rights?
No, we are not... Look, the issue is not how much we spend. It's an attitude. It's creating this community centre for the gays. It's a lot more than money.
What concerns some is that all this talk of tolerance and the mayor's money is being used to deflect attention from the Palestinians, and that gay rights have become a public relations tool. On the other side of the park to the mayor is a group of protesters painted from head to toe in pink.
When tourists come here, they see all this pinkwashing. They see liberal society, they see people who are having fun, drinking alcohol. But within all this, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people in Palestine not being able to come here and celebrate with us, not being able to show themselves, not being able to be really who they are because of our administration.
But you can certainly say that to be a gay or a lesbian, transgender person in the Palestinian territories is a pretty bad deal because of how their society and how their government operates. It's nothing to do with Israel.
Oh, of course it has something to do with Israel because we don't let them get out. They can't go anywhere else. We lock them within their territories.
The struggle that we really fought hard to achieve are being co-opted by the government to try and rebrand itself as this great liberal democracy.
Ayel Gross is Associate Professor of Law at Tel Aviv University.
After the Gaza flotilla, where, you know, 9 people were killed by the Israeli army, so Netanyahu said, oh, human rights group, why do you come to us? Why did you go to a place where they violate gay rights and women's rights, like Iran or Gaza? So you see how the gay rights topic is used as a marker to distinguish us from them and to mark us as a liberal democracy.
But Israel does have gay rights, unlike the Arab countries surrounding it. It is a place where gay people can live a tolerant life, so it's not making something up.
The question is not whether it makes it up or not. The question is how do you instrumentalize gay rights for propaganda?
You know, we saw protesters today who dyed themselves pink, saying, you know, you're pink washing, you're deflecting Israel's attention from what's happening in the occupied territories, and you're giving Israel an image of democracy it doesn't deserve.
Yeah, I will say something rude, you know, and not politically correct, but I don't care.
Councilman Yaniv Weizman.
I know it's doing very good. I know that I can do for the gay community and I can do for the Palestinian community. I can do both together.
Did you send any Palestinians down there on the beach?
Yes, there are not many. You know, there are tourists even from Saudi and from Jordan.
Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, Saudi Arabia. Yeah, they come to celebrate here the freedom. But it's very hard, you know. The gays in Palestine really suffers, not just from rights, but from violence. And if they will be caught, you know, coming here to celebrate, it's really dangerous. But I know few of them who are here celebrating with us. And you know, my dream is that, you know, they will come and celebrate, two people, you know, just celebrating love and freedom.
In a few minutes, we'll track down a gay Palestinian who's made it into Tel Aviv for Pride. Find out how some Orthodox Jews are trying to reconcile their faith and sexuality, and hear from one of the Middle East's biggest and most flamboyant pop stars.
Documentaries on the BBC World Service.
Everybody's dying, people are getting sick.
We didn't know what we were dealing with, we didn't know how to treat it.
I knew that it was getting sicker and sicker.
Why was this? What was it?
People were dying right and left.
And that was the beginning of the nightmare.
It was an infectious killer that appeared from nowhere.
The disease spread so quickly, suddenly around the world in one night.
And some of those who fought it paid the ultimate price.
Said, I've been exposed, I might get infected, this disease might kill me, and if it does, don't cry too much. I did it because I'm a doctor and my duty is to look after sick people.
I'm Kevin Fong, and 10 years on from the SARS outbreak, I'll be meeting the people who put themselves at risk for the sake of others.
It was an odd mixture of excitement and also fear.
Sacrifice, the story of SARS, online at bbcworldservice.com.
I'm Tim Samuels for the BBC World Service. The city's mayor has set out to rebrand Tel Aviv as a bastion of gay freedom in a region that's not known for its tolerance. But what's life like for a gay Palestinian?
It's like being hunted, like a fox being hunted. Over there, he's suspected of being a collaborator. When he's running away here, he's considered to be a security threat. Nobody's on their side. Nobody really wants to help them.
That's Tel Aviv comes out after the news in 2 minutes.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. Mali is holding the final runoff vote in a presidential election aimed at restoring democracy and stability after more than a year of turmoil. A ceasefire that allowed voting to take place in the north also obliges a new government to open peace talks with the separatists. The head of Egypt's top Islamic institution, Al-Azhar, is contacting public and political figures reflecting all shades of opinion with a view to holding a meeting on national reconciliation. It comes amid fears of further bloodshed as the military-backed government has vowed to clear two camps occupied by supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. Australia's Prime Minister Kevin Rudd and the leader of the Conservative Opposition Coalition, Tony Abbott, are beginning their first televised debate ahead of a general election in September. The economy and asylum seekers are expected to dominate the discussion. It's emerged that the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has stolen equipment and supplies paid for by the British government and worth more than $700,000. The thefts began in November 2011 and continued for several months. The family of an American man who was detained in North Korea last year says he's seriously ill and has been moved from a labour camp to hospital. Kenneth Bay, who was sentenced to 15 years hard labour for trying to overthrow the North Korean government, suffers from an enlarged heart and diabetes. A heat wave in much of Japan has raised temperatures to more than 40 degrees Celsius for the first time in 6 years. Health authorities have urged people to take precautions against heat stroke and dehydration by drinking a lot of water and using air conditioning. The authorities in Burma have agreed a deal worth $1 billion to build a second international airport in the main city Rangoon. The airport will be constructed by a South Korean consortium and is scheduled to be ready in 5 years' time. BBC News.
Tel Aviv has become one of the world's leading gay destinations. But as thousands of tourists flock here from around the world to celebrate Pride, what's it like to be a gay Palestinian in this city? I'm Tim Samuels for the BBC World Service. And although we've heard on the grapevine that there are some gay Palestinians in the city, it's been tough to find someone willing to talk directly to us. On his way to meet me here in our apartment is an Israeli community worker, Shaul Ganon, who spent more than a decade working with gay Palestinians.
In the last 15 years, about 1,200 young Palestinians came to our help. Out of them, approximately of 65 agreed to receive our help. When we help Palestinians, it's necessarily expose them to their families, to their neighbors, and they don't wish to do that. They always want to keep a link to their culture or to their family. It's very hard for them.
From the people you've spoken to over the last sort of 15 years, from the stories that you've heard, what's life like for a gay Palestinian?
It's like being hunted, like a fox being hunted by dogs from one side and with people with horses and guns from the other side. Over there, he's a corroborator, suspect of being corroborator. Over there, people want to hurt him based on offending the honor of the Islam, offending the honor of the family. When he's running away here, he's considered to be a security threat. And the Israeli police and security forces are hunting him as well. Nobody is on their side. Nobody really wants to help them.
Why is it that some of the Palestinian families are so against their children being gay and being known to be gay?
Well, first, he's considered to have a spot on the honor of the family. The other thing is that it affects other aspects of Arab culture, like when you do a match, if you've been known that you have a brother that is suspected to be gay, then you have to pay more. So they do believe it's genetic.
The dowry, the wedding dowry cost goes up.
It does.
Are there some Palestinians who manage to live a sort of fairly decent gay life, you know, slightly under the radar?
First of all, there is a change in the Palestinian society during the last years, and you can see most of the changes in places like Ramallah, which is not so religious city, and over there they are coming from rich families, powerful families, and slowly it is changing. And may I say, there is two very courageous organization or Palestinian working in Israel. But when you have access to computer, you can meet people. If you don't have access to all of these things and you have to go to the streets or cruising areas, and then there is a lot of chances that some of the people over there are agents from the secret police or the Palestinian police, and you get arrested.
We've been talking about Palestinians who are in the occupied territories. For Israeli Arabs within the border, how is it for them being gay, and is there a difference if they're from a Christian or a Muslim background?
There is also a big difference if their family are rich, again. There is a difference between the Muslims' attitude and the Christian attitude. If you're Muslim, they would strongly suggest that you would leave the village and you would go to one of the mixed cities such as Haifa, Akko, Tel Aviv, Jaffa, but not over there. Like, do it quietly.
And for Christians?
Christians, less pressuring about marriage, but also they would say something like, you can't stay here.
Leave the village.
Leave the village.
Go to one of the big cities.
Yes.
If we meet up with you on Friday, do you think you could introduce us to someone who's come over from the West Bank?
Yeah, I would do my best. I spoke with some guys, and I think that one or two would come forward and maybe tell his story. You'll have to find a quiet place, because it would be very noisy over there. He's a charming fellow, full of history.
And has he had a tough time?
Yeah, he had a very tough time. I think he tried to kill himself maybe 7 to 8 times from desperation. But he managed to live, so it's a sign from God that he has to live.
Whilst the position for gay Palestinians can seemingly be fraught, Tel Aviv's self-confident tolerance was suddenly shattered in 2009, right in the heart of the city, in the very place where Shaul worked.
Shocked, surprised, terrified. It was so unexpected.
A gunman walked into the gay youth centre and opened fire, killing 2 and wounding 15. An unexpected and incongruous attack that brought about some serious national soul-searching.
The gay community today got a message that Israel, Tel Aviv, no longer a safe place to no one. And if someone can give himself the option just to say hate and to say things against the gay community, today you can see what these words can lead to.
I wasn't there. I arrived 14 minutes after. I identified the bodies, helped to get the last or the two last wounded out to the ambulance, and some pretty nasty sights over there. Gunpowder smell, a lot of blood, and I especially remember a phone in the corner used, you know, to bzz, 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 like ringing on silent, and it was showing mom, mom, mom. Like, mom was calling one of the guys, but I guess he wasn't alive anymore. But we passed that.
Today's papers are reporting some interesting news about the shooting in 2009 at the Gay Youth Centre. They're saying that finally, nearly 4 years later, arrests have been made in connection to the shooting. And this is quite confusing and a little challenging, but talking to some of the gay activists here, they say that Shaul himself has been arrested in conjunction with possibly withholding information or not revealing what he knew, allegedly, about the killings. And he would have been arrested a matter of hours after leaving the flat last night where we interviewed him, and he talked with real emotion about those murders. I don't know what's going to happen. I think he's in custody. I don't know how it's going to play out. But that's a heck of a thing.
As events have become clearer, Tel Aviv police say that Shaul Ganon was at first arrested, but charges were dropped after he agreed to testify. The nation awaits to hear what might have motivated the alleged killer when the case goes to trial. A 2-minute walk from the shootings, another gay couple has just strolled down the leafy boulevard. as I sit reflecting with Gal Yukovsky. In the late 1980s, he wrote a column for an Israeli newspaper imagining the life of a gay couple living openly in Tel Aviv. At the time, homosexuality was illegal, and Independence Park served as a secret meeting place for gay men. A generation later, the rainbow flags are fluttering on the streets, which will see 100,000 gay men and women march with easygoing pride. Gal will be marching with his partner, Eitan Fox, a director whose films such as Yossi and Jagger have helped change the way gay people are viewed in Israel. That marriage isn't an option for them here is more a reflection that there are no civil marriages at all in Israel. But the state does recognise same-sex couples who marry abroad. In this dizzying rush to equality, I ask Gal what have been the cultural milestones en route.
The first gay movie was in the 80s. It was an Amos Gutman movie. I think the first big thing was the series we made, Florentine. We were about a group of young people before and after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And there was a gay couple there for the first time on primetime, and there was the first gay primetime kiss. And all the executives of the network came to the editing room to count how many seconds you can show the kiss before you zoom to the sundown. I think that if you mix the political, cultural, and social, the big moment is Dana International. 1998, she wins Eurovision. We're in our living room with like 20 friends screaming. Then we say, what do we do now? What do we do now? We say, let's go to the Rabin Square, where everybody goes in these events. Let's go there. We have to go there. And the same day, Beitar Yerushalayim, which is the football team, like the disgusting football team of Jerusalem, they hate Arabs, they hate gays, they hate everything. So they won the national football cup. And so all the gays were running to the Rabin Square, and they were running to the Rabin Square as well with flags of Beitar Yerushalayim. And you have these photos where you see gay flags, Beitar Yerushalayim flags, and they're all together and they're all jumping into the water. And this was the moment.
Just gone 1:15 in the morning, and I've come down to the old Jaffa Port area, an industrial area, where one of the old warehouses has been turned into a nightclub, and lots of people are queuing up outside to go in and see one of Israel's biggest names, Dana International. Dana's just come off stage, and we've wound our way through towards the slightly dingy dressing room area of the nightclub, and we've been beckoned in.
Give it your best.
Hi, I'm Tim from BBC from London. How you doing? Lovely show. You got my flowers? Yeah. Oh, there we go. Dana's plonked herself on my lap. It's the interview position I'm generally most comfortable with.
You know, 20 years ago when I started with my sex change, Israel was not such a horrible place.
People said that that wasn't always the case. You know, in the 1980s, you know, people in the early 90s.
I started my career in 1993, you know. I had no problems here. Of course, if you go to Jerusalem to an Orthodox neighborhood, you're going to get a battle on your face. But that's the problem in Israel. But I can tell you, since the 70s, the 60s, it wasn't as free as now, you know. But I remember all these people walking, dressing up, putting makeup, being gay, being lesbian, in the streets.
Do you get any discrimination today?
If I won the Eurovision, so Israel could have sent me around the world as a representative of the foreign minister.
Maybe you could have been a foreign minister.
Maybe in the next life, maybe.
Do you have any fans in the Arab world?
Yes, of course I have, and I would love to go to the Arab world. I love Arab boys, and I would love to go to all Israel's neighbors if we have peace.
Do you think this could be the start of a new peace process that you could start? You could sleep your way around the Middle East and see.
Sex process.
Dana fits the flamboyant face of Tel Aviv, the party town with a penchant for riling the religious down the road in Jerusalem. But in the patchwork of Israeli society, Tel Aviv isn't all secular. The city is home to a religious community, 500 synagogues, and a handful of gay Orthodox Jews who gathered together by the start of the main Pride March.
At one of the stalls here in Meir Park, I've come across Ibn Mayar, who looks a little different to other people here. He has a big black Hasidic Orthodox beard, wearing a yarmulke. It's connected to Havruta, an organisation which is here to show that you can be Orthodox and can be gay. And Daniel, you're with the organisation as well. And you understand English, but you prefer to speak kind of through Daniel. When you were growing up, did you always know that you were gay?
You know, since you were almost born. I mean, back then I did not have the word for it. I did not know what it means. I just know that I'm different.
Was there anyone that you could ever talk to about your feelings for men?
I never had no one to speak with, and that's one of the most hardest things that a young kid has to go through.
How old were you when you came out?
I came out at almost at the age of 26.
What was the reaction of your family?
My family reacted very bad. They immediately went into a deep silence. The things that they did say were usually very harsh. We're trying to fix it now after a few years, but it's still very complicated and hard.
Is it possible to be an Orthodox Jew, a religious Jew, and gay?
Unfortunately, it's not a TV, so you can't see me with the beard, with the yarmulke, with everything. I'm religious, I'm observant Jew, and I'm gay.
Do you think a lot of the gay Orthodox Jews in places like Jerusalem are just suffering in silence or in denial of their sexuality?
I know that there are people that in closet and suffers alone. When I was young, I know that there were people marching to support me, and now I am marching to give them the power and the support, and to let them know that they are not alone.
After you'd come out, what was it like when you kissed a man for the first time?
It just felt right. That's it.
It's been hard in Tel Aviv to find a gay Palestinian from the West Bank to talk about their experiences, not surprisingly. But I found a guy who is willing to. We're going to call him Ahmed. We're going to change his voice and preserve his anonymity for natural reasons. I guess the obvious question is, why do you need to keep your identity secret?
I can say the first thing is that because of my community in the Arab world, it is a shame thing. The shame thing in our country, putting the shame on the family, it controls all the family together.
Would any harm come to you or your family?
No, there is some stories about running away or moving abroad, but I have never heard of anyone injured or killed. I know it may happen, but I don't know.
When did you first tell your family?
I never told them, but they knew. It was obvious. My family take it in a good way. But they were afraid if it was to be known in the community, because my life might not be easy.
So, apart from your family, does anyone else in the community know that you're gay?
No.
What would actually happen to you or your family? What would change if people did know that you're gay?
There are some that would not talk to me anymore.
You're here in Tel Aviv. You're able to cross between the West Bank and Israel. I guess for most people that's not possible.
Most of them, it is rare to find a Palestinian that would get inside Israel. I have a permit.
You've had a good reaction from your family. What's been the experience of other gay people you know in the Palestinian territories?
Most of them, they are not out to their family. Some, they travel abroad to study, or they stay there.
How do you feel when you are in Tel Aviv?
I feel a bit free, but not that much. Because a Palestinian originally from here, I feel some sadness. Because as a Palestinian from here, it is used to be my country. I wasn't supposed to get a permit to get in.
So mixed feelings. You know, you're free to be gay here, but you have the Palestinian feeling of this is your land and you're not here.
Yes.
Speaking to Ahmed, you perhaps sense that for Palestinians in the West Bank, whilst there's some hope, wider tolerance is probably a generation away. That tolerance is more pronounced for Kader. He has Palestinian parents, but was raised in Jaffa, just by Tel Aviv. He can be openly gay. In a restaurant close to the oldest port in the world, he told me about his boyfriend, who's Jewish.
I have a Jewish boyfriend and he is amazing.
Have you met his family?
I met his family and everything.
Has he met your family?
He met my family and my mother really liked him. I'm a vegetarian, so all the food with the meat she sent it to him because I don't eat it. Actually, for my mother it was more difficult when I told her that I'm vegetarian than when I told her that I'm gay.
You grew up in Jaffa.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't so easy.
If you'd grown up in a smaller town or a village, What would it have been like for you?
It would have been tougher. Maybe I was lucky to have grown up in Jaffa, but don't forget that the most population of Jaffa is Islamic. And really, I got lucky because my parents are amazing. So I think if I can take hope from this story is that the reason that I'm sitting with you today and eating falafel, joyfully, and talking about my sexuality is that I was brave enough to stand up for my rights. And I think if you are brave enough, I really believe that if you really are something, don't compromise, just do it.
Does your boyfriend still do army service?
He did army service.
How did you feel when you went off for army service?
It's tough.
When you see him in Israeli army uniform, do you think he looks hot, or do you think, oh my God?
I think that it was really sexy to see him in army uniform, and I think that it was a little bit problematic for me.
I mean, it feels like there's little hope at the moment in this area. Things seem to be getting worse, but can we take a small slice of inspiration from the fact that, you know, you're living here, you've got a Jewish boyfriend, your families like each other, and you can walk down the street together and everything's okay? Can we take something from that?
There is a lot of hope in all of that. We will change this perception. We are, as an Arab community, it's known about us that we are late bloomers. So to the European, everybody can be gay. And for the Jews, it takes like 40, 30 years. At the Arab world, it's going to take more. But it's okay. At the end of the day, we will be there. And I always see this finger over us. You are primitive. And even the press always seeking for the story of the poor guy, the parents killed him. And what's happened when there is a new generation that said, listen, buddy, we are here too, and nobody kill us, and we are living, and we are having fun, and we drink the same coffee at morning, and we drink the same arak or vodka at night, and we're going to a party. So I'm asking why the spot is always on us. Why is always the Arabs?
As Pride prepares to party long into the night, the sunset shimmers over Independence Park, nestled above the sea. Sitting in a circle on the grass, Amichai Lau-Levi leads a group of 20 as they welcome in the Sabbath with an alternative prayer service. A gay Orthodox Jew from a dynasty of 37 generations of rabbis. For Amichai, this park is laden with memories.
This has been the primary cruising site in Tel Aviv for as long as anybody remembers. And in my teens, before online dating and before having the courage to go out to the very few gay places that were here, This is where I would come, with great deal of terror.
Why terror?
Terror of getting what I want, terror of not getting what I want, terror of being me, terror of sex, terror of body, crossing the street into the park, terror of being seen.
And now you're here tonight leading a Sabbath service for a gay community. It's quite a journey.
Yeah.
A journey which you think Israel's been on as well?
Yes. Watching the parade today, this was not possible 20 years ago. It didn't happen 20 years ago. I remember the first public gay pride thing, which was in this park. It was just a bunch of us having a party here on Friday afternoon, and that was drastic and dramatic and new. We were out of the shadows and in the light.
How would the more Orthodox rabbis in Jerusalem see something like this?
The first answer is they would see this probably severely and a challenge to the old ways, and I respect them for that. And the other answer is, without being disrespectful, is that I don't care. This is not their game. This is our game. And there are plenty of ways to play this game.
And you say this having come from, let me get this right, is it 37 generations of...
rabbis.
It's a serious rabbinical dynasty you come from.
Well, as we speak, my uncle is the chief rabbi of the city, and I did not invite him to the circle. And I'm not going to his house for dinner, but I have a lot of respect for him, and I think he has some level of respect for what I'm doing, but it's very difficult for him. I don't want to scorn the old school, but I don't want to be there either. That every single human being is made in the divine image, which is a Jewish saying that very few people really take seriously, means we are all equal, exactly the way we were made. And that's different and messy and complicated, but very sacred and very real. And I think that's where we are today. The 21st century is giving us that ability. You know, walking in this place on many nights was lonely. And leaving the religious fold and my family to do my own thing was lonely. And being able to sit here in a circle and invite people to do a journey into Sabbath with me without compromising our liturgies, but reinterpreting them as queer, and sitting together and being 100% who I am is who I am, is not lonely. And I'm doing it for my own lack of loneliness, but I think there are lots of people who are seeking these type of circles. Whether it's homophobia and hatred of the other, be it a Palestinian or somebody queer. And for me to be here and sitting with you on this bench, it's like shedding light on endless nights. And I hope the circle continues and will ripple, because I think there's a real need for people to find a way to not be alone.
Tel Aviv Comes Out was produced by Barney Rowntree. The executive producer was Gloria Abramoff, and it was made by Tonic Productions for the BBC World Service.